Okay. Well, good morning, everybody. Thanks for being here for the eighth in our series of studying Strange New World. So before we get started, we'll just open in with some quick prayer, okay? Dear Heavenly Father, Lord, thank you for this time that we get to spend the Lord's Day to be able to just worship you, to be able to fellowship with other believers, and to be able to take time to study not only your word, but how society is changing, how we as Christians are called to engage with that society. Lord, give us wisdom to know how to do that. Give us wisdom to understand how to lovingly and winsomely engage our society, but even to understand the ways that society is shifting so we can best influence it for Christ. So please help us now. Give us wisdom. Give us kindness and boldness in what we say and do. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Okay, so So this is the eighth chapter in what we've been studying. This chapter is entitled Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness. I was going to start out by just kind of trying to contrast where we start. And this lesson, to give a little disclaimer up front, this lesson is probably the one that edges the closest to politics and the way that politics play out in society and then how we engage with that as believers. So a disclaimer up front, this is not about politics. This isn't about public policy. This is about how we as believers and Christians can best engage the society wherever God has placed us. And that happens to be for us here and now in this society that's a lot different than it used to look. So with that brief disclaimer, let's just take a step back. And if this chapter is called Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, well, where did that obviously stem from, and how has that changed across time? If we backtrack over two centuries ago, when those words were written in the Declaration of Independence, this is what the text actually says verbatim. It says, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed." So if you take the totality of that sentence, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, and the preamble to it, you realize that there is something there, something significant, something that derives not from ourselves, but derives from something outside ourselves, namely a creator from outside ourselves. Okay, well, so if that's kind of the founding of at least our society that we live in currently here in America, if we fast forward two centuries to today, and really even to the last couple of decades, how has that evolved? How have definitions of life, of liberty, and happiness evolved significantly across time? Well, so if you look at the decision written by Anthony Kennedy, the Supreme Court Justice, in 1991, which was obviously overturned just on Friday, but even as far back as 30 years ago, in that Planned Parenthood versus Casey decision, he writes in there, he says, "At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life." So he's looking not to an external source to define that. Where is he looking? He's looking inside, into one's own right. Everyone has a right, a freedom to be able to define that. And even more recently, in 2006, there was a meeting of a lot of international figures in the kind of trans and LGBTQ plus movement in Indonesia. In 2006, at the Yogyakarta conference, what they sought to do was to set out for every nation in the world what rights should be, what freedoms should be. And so listen to how this is contrasted with what was written back in the Declaration of Independence two centuries ago. They say in there, "Everyone has the right to recognition everywhere as a person before the law. Persons of diverse sexual orientation and gender identities shall enjoy legal capacity in all aspects of life. Each person's self-defined sexual orientation and gender identity is integral to that personality and is one of the most basic aspects of self-determination, dignity, and freedom." And so if you think of the contrast between what was said 200 years ago at the founding of our society and where we have evolved today, it's pretty stark where we have come from. Truman kind of summarizes it in this chapter. He says, the impact of expressive individualism, which is much of what we've been talking about, we talked about last week, and this concept of where we've come to. The impact of expressive individualism on how we think about life and liberty has been dramatic. Old notions such as the sanctity of life, the importance of freedom of religion and speech have been transformed, even inverted, by this new modern self. And all this is because the notion of happiness with which we now intuitively operate is one where a sense of personal, psychological well-being is central. We might say that happiness is for each of us first and foremost an individual thing, resting upon us being independent. All other relationships must serve that end or be seen as oppressive. So what we hope to do, or I hope to do for the next probably 30 minutes or so, is kind of do really four big things. The first one is to synthesize where we've been. This chapter kind of is the so what chapter that takes all the other chapters, all the things that we've learned about, and tries to say, what's really happened? How did we get here? And so we're going to step back a little bit, and we're going to try to quickly, and that's why the scary chart is there, we're going to quickly go back and look at, like, what are the ideas that have been presented? And then in the context of those ideas, what can we learn from that? What implications can we take? We're going to do a couple things. We're going to first try to identify some of the causes that are below the waterline, that big black line on that chart. Essentially the things that we don't really maybe think about, we don't really see, we don't hear expressed, but they're the things that were kind of motivating these changes over the course of not just decades, but really centuries. And so identify some of those so that we can be wise to understand when those things below the waterline are changing society, they're changing culture, and so that we can engage with them properly. But then we're going to look specifically at the implications for what that modern understanding of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness that Truman just talked about. We're going to look at some implications for that so that we can hopefully take away some good practical applications. The first one being that this is about more. What we see going on is about more than just an LGBTQ+ agenda that's being aggressively pursued and pushed. There are root causes. There are things underneath this that are actually maybe sinister is not the right word, but that are actually much more profound in their ability to shape and change the culture and the society that we find ourselves in today. And because those things are happening, because those are below the waterline, we need to understand that we, as believers, we're being shaped. Our worldview, which is a pretty set, strong worldview, that worldview is being shaped by the things that are going on around us. And sometimes it's being shaped in ways that we might not recognize. We might not realize that we are slowly being inched in a certain direction. And so identifying the fact that we're being pushed in that direction is important just to understand it, to know that that's happening, and then potentially to engage with that. And then finally, we also need to be wise about how in some areas, not only are we being shaped, but in some areas, we as Christians in this society have actually been complicit in this happening in some ways. We're not overtly complicit. We're not saying, yes, go advance that agenda. But we're complicit in the fact that we may allow certain categories of discussion. We may allow certain things to become normative, not only in the speech around us, but normative for us. And when we start to do that, we actually may be complicit in advancing some of these same agendas. Okay, so now you might be, so if that's kind of the opening, you might be asking yourself, well, can't we just hate the sin, love the sinner, and move on? Isn't that kind of what we're called to do? Well, yeah, obviously we are called to do that. We are called to love the sinner, engage with them winsomely. But I think what Truman would say is that this is now systemic across our entire society. This is beyond the individual level of the individual sinner. That's still important. We still need to engage with that. But it's systemic across our society because of that. We have got to think even more broadly about it. And then you could also say, won't this kind of progressive pendulum that is right now really aggressively swinging to one side, won't it eventually just kind of swing back to the center so we can all just kind of get along again and everybody has their rights and their freedoms? And I think what Truman would say is that there is not a pendulum. There is no pendulum. There is right now a runaway train going in a certain direction. And because of that, we can't just expect that this is going to swing back. There's something different going on than a traditional left-right swing. Something fundamentally different, something that directly opposes those traditional values. And that's what we're going to use that chart to do today, to maybe unpack that a little bit and understand why is it that there maybe is no pendulum at all. Okay. But before we dig in, so before we kind of get into some really heady philosophical stuff, and before we talk about, gosh, there is a significant spiritual fight ahead and cultural fight ahead, I think it's important for us to remember that there is, we have a hope that goes beyond all this stuff. And in fact, not just a hope, this was expected. We have been told that this is going to happen. And as believers, we should be fully expecting that this is what we are going to experience. So if we take a look at John 17, 13 through 18, Jesus in there says, "But now I'm coming to you, and these things I speak in the world, that they may have my joy fulfilled in themselves. I have given them your word, and the world has hated them, because they are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. I do not ask that you take them out of the world, but that you keep them from the evil one. They are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. Sanctify them in your truth. Your word is truth. As you sent me into the world, so I have sent them into the world." This is expected. This is what we should expect in this day and age, really any day and age, as believers living in society. So with that slight, you know, kind of caveat of hope before we get into this, it's also important for us to recognize that it's easy for us to talk about philosophy. It's easy for us to talk about history and the things that have happened. But ultimately, and Truman goes into this, these are spiritual problems. Underneath all this, these are spiritual problems. And I don't want to make light of that. I don't want to go, we're going to spend a lot of our time talking about other things. We don't want to make light of the spiritual problems, the spiritual causes that we see in Romans 18, where it talks about, for example, the wrath of God revealed from heaven against ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. And then later, though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, claiming to be wise, they became fools. And then later, therefore, God gave them up in the lust of their heart to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves. And later, for this reason, God gave them up to dishonorable passions. There is a spiritual causality behind all these things, certainly at an individual level. But what we're going to try to do is take a step back and talk even more broad at a societal level about what's been going on. Okay, so to dig into this and to dig into this chart a little bit, what are some of those root societal causes? And then how have we been shaped, even deceptively shaped, changed even our worldview a little bit because of these things? And what are the ways that we are conceding some of these points? If you take out your horrible Air Force chart, I'm sorry if you're in the Navy or if you're in the Marine Corps here, this is a little bit advanced. Okay, so if you take out this chart and look in the bottom left-hand corner, what we're going to try to do for this is essentially just an attempt to chart out what are the arguments that Truman has made and how do they relate to each other across those different arguments. At the bottom left-hand side of this chart are two things. It says meaning and identity. This book has been all about meaning and identity and how the sense of the self, who we are, has changed across time. In the bigger book that associates this one, the longer book, Truman talks a lot about across history, the way that man has kind of defined their identity. And it started out when he described this back in like Greek and Roman times with someone known as political man. Our identity was defined by the city-state, by the polis, by the group of political people around us in relation to other politics or groups. And that our meaning, our definition of truth, where we get our understanding of what makes the world work, why does all this happen? The way that we get that meaning for that political man was from our traditions. It was from the writings of, you know, the Aeneid and the Odyssey and things like that. Those myths, that is how they got their definition of what is right and what is truth. Well, that evolved over time to then what is the way we see it in society as religious man, where your faith and religion became central to your meaning. If you think back to the year 1000, you did not have a choice whether or not you were going to be a Christian. You were. Everyone in society, at least in Europe, was essentially a Christian. And your very definition of meaning and how you understood life was entirely defined by that. But then the way that we derived our meaning from that was, in that case, for religious man, came from God. The truth that we had didn't come from outside, you know, whether it's myths or traditions. It came from a deity, from a being outside, external to ourselves, that helped define for us what is truth, what is reality, what is important in life, what is right, what is good. Well, then contrast that with how things continued to evolve across time. From around the 1500s or so, is what Truman says, there were two more evolutions. The first one was an evolution into economic man, which we won't go into a lot of details, because that was kind of like what was prevalent at the time. We were really focused on economies and trying to develop wealth, and that was great and good. But at the same time, while that was going on, there was the transition to what we are seeing today, which is something known as psychological man. Or the idea that the way that we understand who we are, the identity that we have, comes from within. It comes from ourself. And so that when we think of meaning, when we think of what is truth, what is good, it doesn't come from an external source like we had back with political man or religious man. It now comes from an internal source where we not only get to express what we think that is, we get to define whatever that is. We get to define truth. We get to define what is good, what is right. And that then derives into what Truman calls expressive individualism, where the individual self gets to express whatever they think, not only who they are, but what truth is for them, what good is for them. And so that transition and meaning and identity from political to religious and then to psychological man is foundational to what we see going on today. And the reason it's foundational is that red line at the bottom, those two red lines down at the bottom. Truman said that something really significant happened, whereas the political man could kind of get along with religious man, right? You had common thing. You might not agree on everything. You might not agree on, you know, what you believe, but you had common definitions about what life was. Things were defined externally to you. But something unique happened in the advance of political man, where suddenly if what I determine, if what arises from me as truth, as of what is good, if what I say is right, if you don't agree with that, well, you're not only disagreeing with me, you're actually attacking my basic beliefs about what is true, about what is good. And you're attacking the things that are foundational to my understanding of reality. And because of that, you're attacking my existential beliefs. It'd be just like someone attacking a foundational aspect of the church, that by attacking that truth, you are attacking me as a person, because that is the truth that I define. And because of that, I will directly oppose any kind of idea or any kind of culture that has an external constraint coming in. Anything that defines truth externally, anything that defines what is good externally, I will directly oppose that as psychological man. And that's where Truman gets the idea of something called the anti-culture, or the attacks that go back from psychological man to anything else that would impose something on him. And we're going to keep coming back to that kind of anti-culture and those external forces that are against us. Well, so if that's kind of how it's progressed in meaning identity from religious man eventually to psychological man, which Truman would say is prevalent today, that's how our society defines itself. There, during that time, there were ideas that would bubble up from the surface, that would bubble up underneath that would come from those philosophies, those understandings of meaning and identity, that then would be played out in ideas that thinkers would have, key thinkers across the ages, and that those ideas then would start to go above that black line, that water line, to start seeing it in society. So that unless you were somebody, an academic that studied these things, you weren't really aware that all of that was what was going on underneath the waterline. But you would start seeing things above the waterline in your day-to-day life. You would see things like above the waterline, the rights that you might have, that your government might be giving you, that you might believe that you should have. And then, even above that, you might start seeing how society is taking all those ideas and turning them into action. Whether it's the type of governments that we have, whether it's the type of things that we believe, whether it's the type of things that we would emphasize and say, this is good and this is right in society. And so across those changes from religious man to psychological man, we also had changes, significant changes in the ideas that were put forward. First, in the idea for religious man of a sin nature, and we're all very familiar with what that is and what that means. Well, that idea of innate sin inside every human being because of the fall would translate above the waterline into certain rights and ideas. Rights like life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness that were biblically defined, but that also then would translate into a society that would recognize that people are innately sinful, and left to themselves without good governance, they will do things that are selfish. They will do things that are evil left to themselves. And so we need to put into place certain rights and capabilities, but also certain governments to allow us to kind of to keep that in check. Well, that idea of a sin nature for religious man started to change across time when we transitioned to psychological man. As we move to the right, you can see ideas bubbling up from people like Rousseau, which we've talked about in the past couple of weeks, where he said that we're not naturally sinful. If left to ourselves, if we go back to the core of who we are, without these repressive societies, without governments, without churches, our nature is actually good. What we find at our core is actually good. And so what we need to do is to unshackle ourselves from that, from those things that would keep that good from coming out. We get corrupted by society. We get corrupted by governments. We get corrupted by institutions like the church. And so Rousseau sought to get back essentially to nature. And that idea, that initial idea, then was taken and was advanced by Marx and others. And Marx then, fully now in the psychological man court, said, well, if I can define my own set of truth, and if I am good by my own nature, if I'm naturally good, then whatever that outside, whatever those outside forces, whether it's a church, whether it's a religious belief, whether it's an institution, whether it's a government, what they are doing to me, it's not, they're not just kind of repressing me a little bit. They're directly oppressing me. And so the idea that political oppression and politics involves everything is central to what Marx started to believe. And so whereas Rousseau said, well, let's get back to the natural man because that's good. Marx said, no, let's not only do that. Let's directly oppose anything that would try to keep us from that natural man, that would try to keep us from there. And so the idea of those, of political oppression and the idea of trying to remove those that would oppress us really comes to the forefront. And we start to see that above the waterline, both for Rousseau and Marx, you see in the middle two arrows, as it goes above the waterline, we get to the ideas of suddenly equality of income, where everyone should get the same amount of money in and we should all be equal. We get the idea of political oppression and starting to restrain the right of others to be able to say what they want to say, or restrain them in government. And we start to see that in the society line at the very top, where we start to not only remove the influences of the church as a valid way to think about things, such as the secularization in our view of life, when it comes to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. We see the weakening of religion and the politicization of speech, the ability to be able to openly speak. And then we also see, as we continue to move to the right, that eventually, when we get to Marx, suddenly our view of life, and the idea of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, our idea of life becomes not just, you know, secularized, it becomes utilitarian, which means that, well, I will only value life in as much as it serves the greater society, the greater government, the people. If life does not serve the greater people, then we should end that life. And we see this in the practice of eugenics across time, the practice of infanticide and euthanasia, because if that life doesn't help society, it should be gone, because they don't define life anymore. Coming up from those ideas of Marx, they don't define life in that way. And then eventually we get to the very on the right hand side of the graphic, where now Freud takes the ideas of Marx, those initial ideas of we have an oppressed good nature, and he transitions to that to we have an oppressed sexual nature. And he starts to sexualize everything about what it means to be in society, what it means to be right, to have truth. Everything is essentially sexualized. And that same concept of, well, I'm being repressed as a person, or I'm being oppressed as a person inside the Marxian idea of life. Now Freud takes that and says my sexual identity is being also repressed. And since my innate, if we go all the way back to psychological man, what I feel is true, what I feel is good, if that is the ultimate good, and if that is being oppressed, then I should be able to express that freely any way I want. And not only to express it freely, an important point, think back to these red lines, I need to have the right to directly oppose and politically attack anyone who is trying to keep me from doing that. If anyone doesn't directly affirm the fact that this is a good, that what you are saying is good, whatever you define as good, then you are actually directly opposing me, and that is evil. That is wicked. And so we see a complete twist from back to what, at least in the Declaration of Independence, the definition of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, what underpinned that, to today, where now if you are not directly trying to affirm what I am saying, whatever my internal beliefs are, that you are actually stigmatizing those beliefs. You are oppressing me, and I should be allowed to directly oppose you. And so in the upper right-hand corner, we can see that in the top five kind of things across the ways that Truman describes how we see society today, a utilitarian view of life, that religion isn't just kind of, well, let's just put that in its box. Let's just put that in the corner. It's no longer in a box. It's no longer in a corner. Because of these red lines down here, they need to directly oppose religion. Because what is a faith? A faith, essentially, is looking for an external reality outside of ourselves. And because of that, they have to directly oppose that. Again, this gets back to the idea of that pendulum. If there was a pendulum, then eventually they go, okay, and now we'll let it go back to the center again so that we can say, yeah, well, let's all just get along. But if they have to directly oppose that same belief that was externally derived, they'll now essentially say, No, we will never get back to that. In fact, we will only progress away from that, away from those kind of externally derived truths. And because of that, we also then see things like the censorship of speech. Rather than the freedom of speech that we would have had like from the Declaration of Independence, we now see a censorship of speech. Because your ability to speak, if I am internally deriving what is true and what is right and expressing that, if you do not affirm that, that's not just like an inconvenience for me. That is a direct opposition to what I believe. And because of that, I actually silence that. Remember back to Marx. Marx told me I have to oppress that and I have to silence that thing. And so the attacks on things like freedom of speech that we see today, Truman would say, find their root back in these same psychological man that it started with. Because that psychological man isn't trying to go along to get along. He's trying to directly oppose any concepts that go against what they feel is the most important thing. We also see changes in education and what we view as valid for education. Truman talks about in chapter 8 the fact that whereas back in the Declaration of Independence, there were things, when it came to education, we would try to educate to inform, to say, you as a child, you are naive. And we need to impart wisdom that has been learned over the decades by actually externally imparting that wisdom to you. And across time, Truman says that with these different, the advent of religious man and psychological man, we go from education to inform to education to activate, to try to make you an activist for these political causes. And eventually, on the right-hand side, eventually today, education to liberate your thought, to become whatever psychological man you want to be. Whoever you want to be, all that we are trying to do is remove those shackles from you that had repressed your internal desires to do whatever you wanted to do, and we're allowing you to learn how to become the whoever you want to be. And then finally, when it comes to happiness, whereas back on the far left-hand side in the blue box, we would have defined Judeo-Christian morality broadly as what kind of determined happiness. Seeking out those kind of important things is what gave happiness in life. Whereas today, happiness is overtly described as essentially expressive individualism, where if you can just express whoever you are and you want to be from that psychological man, that is what gives ultimate happiness. Okay, so that's at least my small attempt in trying to identify how did we get here from 200 years ago to today, and what are the things that Truman has kind of told us across time throughout this book about how we got there. And so if that's the case, then we need to ask some questions and hopefully have about 10 minutes here to kind of discuss some of those things. We've already hit on kind of what are some of those root societal causes that transition from religious man to psychological man that go behind these. But what are some of the ways that we as Christians are being shaped by society? What are some of the practical ways now that we've kind of unpacked that a little bit? What are some ways that we might have even changed our worldview a little bit in ways that we didn't recognize, in ways that was done kind of underneath the waterline, whether it's in TV, music, advertising? Can anybody think of ways that this practically might have been done over the course of the last 10, 20, even 100 years? Absolutely. You certainly see it in people feeling like, yeah, they don't really need to go join a local body, church. It's not that, maybe important, because whatever I want to do, it gets right back to that kind of individual self. That's a great point, Rick. What other ways? Absolutely. You certainly see it played out in the ways that some some groups would worship today that's quite focused on an individual expression, an individual experience of what that's like, rather than a corporate worship that is going towards an external kind of source. Great point. That is such a good point, because if you think back to on our diagram, when we transition from religious man to psychological man, that you are being now repressed, and any external pressure going against you is bad. That gets to the idea that something like church discipline would be completely anathema to our current society. I think that's why when we were joining the church as members, I think it was Mitch that said church discipline is important in this church. We need to make sure that we're, and I was like, yes, thank you. That's a really good thing.
Yes, sir.
I was like, yes. Okay. But it's good. But it showed how important that is, that why something like that, you know, normally we hope we don't have to exercise those things, but that is something that's vital to the life of the church, to make sure that these truths are being externally applied on us. That's a really good point. Any other ideas there? Absolutely. If their happiness is only internally derived, then suddenly anything that's impeding upon that internal happiness needs to be almost, you know, thrown off or even oppressed. Great point. Mitch? That's a really good point. Do you feel like over time, because based on kind of Truman's thesis here, he would say that those traditional ideas need to be, you know, we need to kind of like set those aside a little bit, but that they've actually been actively attacked, or even that it's now wrong to even believe those. Do you feel like over time, have you seen a shift towards that, where they were just kind of, you know, fringe ideas, to where now it's actually wrong to have those kind of ideas? Okay, another kind of question related to that to think about. Truman talks towards kind of the end of the chapter. He implies that we as believers, as Christians, we have really for the last couple decades, in some ways, we have actually been complicit in the advancement of many of these things. And we haven't done it over, we haven't said, yes, those are good things, not like that. But we've been complicit in the way that we haven't realized that these things have been kind of percolating below the surface. And we've even acknowledged or supported some things that have maybe encouraged it. He uses the example of a book in 2019 by Zondervan called Costly Obedience, What We Can Learn from the Celibate Gay Community. And in that, and it sounds, it was a Christian book learning about how gay people are trying to be celibate to not go out. And he says, by saying that their obedience is costly to them, is essentially saying that they're being harmed they're going against their true self. If they believe that they're gay, they're going against their true self, and that is costly to them. And so you're essentially acknowledging that what they are doing is not acknowledging that psychological man, that psychological self. You're not, and because they're not doing it, it's costly and it's hard. And he's saying by doing that, you're essentially allowing them that ground. You're saying that's an okay thing, or at least you're implying that concept of that's a cost and that that's a harm that's being done to them. And it's in little things like that over the course of the last couple of decades that we might have actually given a lot of ground, not realizing that we were doing it, Sri. And it's easy to do, though, because, I mean, we see the culture around us doing it. We don't realize that we're almost being complicit in it when we do it. Okay. One final question. So based on all this, and this is really what we're going to talk about next week in the final chapter, is going to be, okay, so now what? What do we do? How do we engage? Any initial thoughts on like how, based on what we've talked about, based on what we've tried to unpack here as some of the causes, how we can engage effectively for Christ in this society? I know most of us, you know, live and work. Many of us live and work in the society. Some of us work in the government, which makes it even more difficult because we're often compelled to affirm things that we might feel like we cannot affirm those things. So there is not just a tension, there's a direct opposition to our ability to be able to engage the culture. Any thoughts on how to do that effectively to try to prelude next week's discussion? Outstanding. Well, those are great, great preludes to next week and what we'll talk about for trying to be able to engage society. With that, Elder Rick, you mind close us in prayer?